The conflict in Darfur has had a devastating impact on Sudan's neighbors. The Associated Press reported just today that the Central African Republic is dealing with a new insurgency in its northeast near the Darfur region, creating instability and displacing tens of thousands of people. The situation in Chad is equally bleak, with tribal leaders asking for a UN peacekeeping force to assist them in protecting the over 200,000 Darfur refugees who live in camps on Chad's side of the border. Mia Farrow, who's been a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador since 2000, recently visited the Central African Republic and Chad, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome her back to my show. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How much traveling in Africa have you done on behalf of UNICEF?
Well, four trips to this region, three of them for UNICEF, and last November I went to Eastern Chad on my own because we were evacuating at that point, and I just felt it was important to be there.
And when did you go to the Darfur region the first time?
Darfur twice, in 2004 and last June.
And has the situation deteriorated, or does it look pretty much as bad?
Well, it depends on which way you want to look at it. 2004 was a terrible year for Darfur. And in the interim, we have 14,000 aid workers sustaining 4 million lives. 80 to 90% of Darfur's villages have been destroyed, bombed and burned by the government of Sudan and, as most people know, their proxy Arab militia known as the Janjaweed.
But this is a civil war that's been going on since 1984. Why is it something that we are just really have only been made aware of in the last few years?
No, you're referring to the North-South. There was a war in the South where oil was found, and that was a long war between North and South Darfur, Southern Sudan and the rest of Sudan.
Well, doesn't this grow out of that?
No. The Darfur region is something separate, and there was an insurgency there in 2003 when the people of Darfur wanted some of the share of what had been the agreement between the North-South Agreement, what's commonly called. And there, in response to this uprising, Khartoum initiated an all-out attack upon the civilian black African villages of Darfur. This attack has lasted now 4 years, and it continues a rampage of killing that involves mutilations of the worst kind, atrocities. And
how many deaths, do you know?
Well, no one's doing the body count, but people estimate over 500,000. And then we have 2.5 million that are registered in the camps, which are deplorable by any standards, just, you know, sheeting lashed to the desert floor. 2.5 million souls living in deplorable conditions, and another 2 million just sheltering wherever they can. More than 250,000 have fled into, of all places, Chad, which has not been able to accommodate them. And Darfur's Janjaweeds have now attacked them in Chad. Chadian villages are burning.
Chad has its own political problems.
So, it does indeed.
So this probably adds to the instability.
Well, its own problems. We're looking now at the Darfur border, and the problems there are really coming out of Darfur. The Janjaweed, financed by the government of Sudan, backed and armed by them, are making these incursions into eastern Chad and are joined by Arab militia there.
Well, the UN has very specifically blamed the Sudanese government for this situation. Some people are using the word genocide. So why has it been continuing? Haven't we seen an intervention similar to what we saw in Bosnia and Kosovo?
I think that we're seeing one of the most fragile aspects of the United Nations. The United Nations has utterly failed the people of Darfur. We have no precedent at the UN for so-called intervention without the consent of the government of Sudan, perpetrators of the genocide. So,
we have to get General Omar al-Bashir to say, come in and stop what I have been fomenting before anything can be done?
Right. It's absurd to even think of saying, like, excuse me, Mr. Hitler, can we come in and, free the people from the camps? No? Oh, okay. Gee, a lot of hand-wringing has gone on now for 4 years. It was passed under a Chapter 7 mandate, this Resolution 1706, that would have deployed 22,500 troops into Darfur. But the fact is the members of the not only the Security Council, but the member states, would not donate troops to provide such a force to enter. So really what I'm thinking is there should be a permanent UN peacekeeping force. When a determination of genocide is made, that this force would automatically go in to save innocent civilians and aid workers who are putting their own lives at risk to save them.
But isn't there also a problem at the UN that little can be done without the support of important countries, in this case, Russia and China? Why have they been a roadblock?
You got that right. China's on the Security Council, and China has massive oil interests in Sudan. These two oil companies, PetroChina and Sinopec, are pouring billions of dollars into Khartoum. Some say 80% of that is used to buy gunships, helicopters, small arms, all sorts of ammunition and uniforms and training to be used against the people of Darfur. This for a country, including Antonov bombers, for a country that has no need for any self-protective military, defensive military.
My guest is Mia Farrow, who has been a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador since 2000. We're talking about the situation in Darfur and in the two neighboring countries most affected by the turmoil there, Chad and the Central African Republic. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you're a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF, but not for the UN, because you're critical of the UN.
Well, we can love the UN and still be critical. I mean, we can urge. The fault lies with the international community. The UN is also the member states. And if the UN implores the member states to donate a force to go in and the world turns away, it says more about the member states. But it also says, you know, the UN is under certain circumstances helpless to do more. They are talking and a lot of talk now about sending troops into eastern Chad. And that is the next best scenario and must happen. It's past time to provide protection.
You just went there.
I just came back from eastern Chad. That's Darfur's borders with Chad and with Central African Republic. I went to both places.
What are the conditions in the refugee camps like?
Well, the refugee camps in eastern Chad are actually better than the camps in Darfur. The Chadian people have accommodated the influx of Darfurians with extraordinary generosity, and UNHCR is doing their best to provide them with sustain them. The real problem there, I mean, it is a problem for the refugees, but it's also a problem for the internally displaced people. More than 60 villages have been burned by the Janjaweed. This has caused an immense displacement of Chadians, when I was there in November. In the little hospital, which was just, the wounded were pouring out into the courtyard. Three men lay side by side with their eyes gouged out. I mean, these atrocities as villagers stood with their bows and arrows against machine guns and Kalashnikov rifles to defend their villages. The brutality is beyond description. So it's the internally displaced people we have to think of as well, a protection force for them everywhere, though water was insufficient, though food was insufficient.
You said that some people were actually trying to get water out of mud.
They were literally sucking mud. I saw children sucking the mud to get the water out. But even above that, the plea was for protection.
Because of rape. And
murder,
and other
rape. People are not safe in their villages or even in their camps. The camps are raided.
You wrote in the Los Angeles Times about meeting a young woman whose son was taken from her arms and bayoneted.
Bayoneted before her eyes. I wear this good luck charm that she gave me. Three of her five children were murdered similarly that day. Janjaweed, she told me, they cut them and threw them in the well. And she took my two hands and begged me, tell people what is happening here. Tell them we will all be slaughtered. Tell them we need help. Well, this was in 2004. I'm still telling people.
Well, with all the other crises in the world right now, Iraq, Afghanistan, tensions with Iran, climate change, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, do you find that it's more difficult to mobilize people to act in Darfur?
I think we're seeing a huge civic response to the Darfur crisis. When you say it's a genocide and innocent civilians are being killed by a government, it does put it in a different league in terms of capturing the conscience, especially of young people. So across universities where I speak, I'm, you know, greatly heartened by the civic response and bipartisan response of the young. It has not been enough to push the political will to actually do something, but let's keep trying, you know, call our legislators and call the White House and make it clear what should be done. And let's not forget the people of Central African Republic either.
A listener writes, why is no organization calling for U.S. consumers to boycott Chinese goods until they stop supporting the government of Darfur? Boycott Chinese goods in Walmart, the writer says, for example.
I think that's too broad. I think we should boycott the oil industry that's actually pouring money into Khartoum. China has legitimate trade that doesn't go into Khartoum. There is a website, sudandivestment.org, or if you go to my website, miafarrow.org, it will link you to other sites that where you can. I mean, I didn't realize I had my own pension plan in Fidelity Mutual Funds, which pours its money into PetroChina, which in turn is financing a genocide. So,
do you think that if you took your money out and others did, that Fidelity might divest themselves of those stocks?
One would wish that Fidelity should do that for the moral reasons. It's the same reason, you know, I feel that the UN should go in because morally it's the right thing to do, and that should supersede national sovereignty.
So is Fidelity the worst perpetrator?
There are others, too. Check the website, but Fidelity is massive. Siemens, the huge German company, did pull out. And many states have divested, and universities led by Harvard have divested. So we look to Fidelity to do that.
You mentioned the situation in the Central African Republic. This is a country that has an army, a few of them 4,500 men, with 4 million population, and actually only 1,000 soldiers actively deployed.
Right.
So they couldn't be expected to maintain order even under the best of circumstances.
Yeah, Central African Republic is a collapsed state. The president, Bozizé, really has jurisdiction only over the town of Bangui, and then only sometimes. So his position is fragile. He's got a presidential guard who, by all accounts, and the people we spoke to are actually responsible for the burning of countless villages. There's the army, which doesn't even have any barracks, and they're rampant. They're just everywhere, and no one seems to be able to control them. There are four different rebel groups. There are incursions from Chadians. And now along Darfur's border, there are incursions from Janjaweed. So, and the end result is a population which has literally fled into the bush. Hundreds of thousands of people have been living in the bush, eating leaves and roots for over a year. And we stopped our vehicle along the road, and people, after a time, we were just quiet, standing there with UN flags. People started coming out of the bush, 2, 10, 50, 300. Like specters they came, just in caked in mud with vestiges of clothes or no clothes at all. Their teeth rotted out. And they came and told us, our children are dying. We have nothing to eat. We have no medical attention. And they were completely traumatized. And the one car that we met on the 3 days of our journey across northwestern Central African Republic was coming the other way. We heard the car coming. It happened to be a Human Rights Watch group coming. But they heard the car coming. And those hundreds just in an instant had disappeared back in the bush in sheer terror.
Isn't part of the problem in sorting all of this out that the political entities are all implicated in different ways? You mentioned Chad getting involved with the Central African Republic's politics. Chad has also been accused of supporting certain groups in Darfur. Chad is a victim. The real victims here are the people who live in the area, but the governments don't seem to be part of the solution. They seem to be adding to the problem.
This is true. So what we want to see really is that protection, international protection force in Chad and in the Central African Republic to provide a safe zone for not only the human beings who are there, but the aid workers who need to meet their needs. It's not safe for them. In Darfur, 14 have been killed since June. It's not safe for them in eastern Chad. We're in level 4, which means we're just down to the skeletal amount of aid workers, nowhere near enough to address the enormity of the situation. And in Central African Republic, nobody's there. No UN agencies. Only people we saw there were a little unit of Médecins Sans Frontières.
And we'll talk about that and why there isn't UN representation and the whole safety matter as we continue our conversation. My guest is Mia Farrow, who has been a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador since 2000. She's just returned from a visit to the Central African Republic in Chad just earlier this month.
Well, no, it was day before yesterday.
The day before yesterday. Oh, well, that's very recent.
Yes.
So we're getting the latest news, and we will continue.
I'm a little jet-lagged. Sorry if I sound it.
No, you sound fabulous. And we will continue right after this. We're back with Mia Farrow, who just returned a day and a half ago from visits to Chad and the Central African Republic to look into the refugee situation there and the general situation of political instability, all of it growing out of what's been going on in Darfur. And I mentioned earlier that it's hard to find any heroes in all of this. Perhaps just the briefest recap of the situation, how we got here.
Well, if you look to an uprising in Darfur, rebel groups wanting some kind of compensation. The North-South Agreement had happened. You referred to it earlier. A battle between the north of Sudan and the south had ended with a peace pact. And Darfur, which had been left essentially in the Stone Age, there was an uprising there. In response to this, the government of Sudan launched an all-out attack upon the civilian population of Darfur.
After one of the rebel leaders died in a crash, wasn't
it? No, that's in southern Sudan. That was John Garang and... It's
so that's separate,
separate.
And sometimes they all seem to merge.
It does, but in western Sudan is the Darfur region, and it is separate and has been kept separate, and it's a black population, indigenous population, and you could call the rest of Sudan Arab, though it is mixed, but it's of Arab culture and many of it of Arab descent and Arab by identification. So the Arab government of Sudan launched an all-out attack upon the black African villages of Darfur. Now 90% have been destroyed.
Now, people who explain it a different way have told me that to some degree this has less to do with religion and more to do with lifestyle, that the people of Darfur were basically farmers and that the Janjaweed were nomadic people who wanted to be able to travel through these areas without having to worry about anyone else's
property rights. Yeah, that is so. It's not religion. They're all Muslims. Muslim against Muslim.
Now, you mentioned the safety factors. The UN, according to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, has raised with the Security Council the whole matter of whether he can guarantee the safety of peacekeepers. How dangerous is it?
Well, I would say in Darfur, nobody's safe. In eastern Chad, nobody's safe.
How secure did you feel when you were traveling through the area?
I would just say nobody's safe. We're at level four. Level five is evacuation and the cessation of all programs of UN. So level four is the families are evacuated and you're down to just bare skeleton. And we don't have a presence in Central African Republic. And part of that is the extreme volatility of the region.
So is there any precedent for this sort of situation?
Of this situation, I guess you'd have to look back in history. You mean of collapsed states and people being killed, of genocide? Yes, there is precedent, sadly.
I meant a precedent for the UN to deal with.
To go into a country without permission? No, there isn't. And I think there has to be a provision for that. My own feeling, and I've said this before, a permanent peacekeeping force that would be on tap when a determination of genocide is made. Now, the United Nations has had to avoid the use of the word genocide. Jan Egeland has been most eloquent in calling it atrocities of the worst kind, ethnic cleansing, but he's been unable to use the word genocide because that would imply that we have to take some action. Now, Colin Powell made that determination in 2004, September. I remember the moment. But in the same paragraph, he went on to say this doesn't imply that we have to do anything about it, thereby pretty much killing the Genocide Convention. But no, one would like to see just even the threat of a peacekeeping force going into Darfur would have, I'm sure, stopped this 4 years ago when it was a whole lot simpler.
I understand that your son, Ronan Farrow, has also traveled extensively through Africa. Inspired by your activism?
Well, actually, he got his own position at UNICEF as their only youth spokesperson. I brought him with me because he went to college at 11, and he finished college at 15, and he was so on fire to make a difference. He got himself into Yale Law School, took 2 years off, and in those 2 years, he worked for Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, but he also traveled with me twice to the region and has written some eye-popping pieces, a Wall Street Journal article, which really explains China's entanglement, China's oil entanglements with Sudan. No, I'm very, very proud of him. He's a wonderful young man. And it just shows, I mean, children needn't be marginalized, that he got right in the thick of things and making a difference.
But it's interesting that someone who has taken some time off from law school is doing the kind of investigative journalism that perhaps journalists should be doing. Do you think that part of the problem in dealing with this, at least for the general public, is that we really haven't had it explained well, that not just the television stations, which give you 2 seconds of Darfur, but even our major newspapers haven't really laid it out the way that might be necessary?
Yeah, I think it's about our priorities in the press. We see hundreds of hours on, some misfortune of one girl missing on an island, and it is a tragic thing.
Britney Spears cutting off her hair.
There you go. Or the death of this woman in the
Anna
Bahamas.
Nicole Smith.
Yes, hundreds of hours. And I think if you count, you could count the minutes on two hands that have been devoted to the Darfur genocide over the last year. So we're not looking at numbers when we prioritize. We'll see, 100 hours on a cat stuck in a drain and nothing on 100,000 people dead. What is it that we're unable to fix onto it? Is it a race problem? Is it because they're black? Is it the remoteness of it? Is it the press not doing their job? Should there be a shakeup of the news whereby so-called news people should have to do their job and it should be about the numbers? Is it really important to know the details of Ms. Spears' haircut, or is it more important to do our job? I mean, look at the rush to Iraq. We saw, Ted Koppel riding in a tank into Baghdad when really he should have been doing his homework to say, well, really, are there weapons of mass destruction? It hasn't really been proved. I didn't find those photographs comprehensible.
Well, part of the problem there with the American public is that we mistrust the UN. Many people here do. And so when Hans Blix went in there and said, I can't find anything, and there was every reason to believe him, people were not believing him because he was just one of those mess-ups who works for the UN.
Gee, I wouldn't be so dismissive about the UN. They have failed here and there, but I think we need to support them. They are the best institution we have, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, but you understand that there is mistrust. Now there's mistrust of the Bush administration as well, so people tend to look at the last failure, and the UN did have a number of problems in Yugoslavia, for example, where and Rwanda, which was rather horrifying.
Well, it was indeed, and you could look at this problem in Darfur and say, well, it's Rwanda in slow motion, as if that has been said, as if history gave us another chance and said, you really dropped the ball on Rwanda, nearly a million people slaughtered. I'm going to give you another chance, and this time you're not going to be able to say you didn't know what to do about it.
Well, aren't there some French troops in the region? After all, Chad is a former French colony. I don't know where the Central African Republic, too.
I did see French troops in Central African Republic. There are about 300 of them. They were there on the border on the border with Sudan, along with Chadian troops and along with Central African Republican troops. There are troops in Chad. I didn't see them, but they have not provided a protection force.
My guest is Mia Farrow, who has just returned from a visit to two of Sudan's neighbors and Darfur's neighbors, the Central African Republic and Chad. Do you see a situation similar to what may be happening in Yugoslavia as a solution to Sudan? Sudan is a huge country. Would partition be an answer?
No, I think the Darfur region, again, isolated from the rest of Sudan, if there was a peace force in there of NATO capacity, you know, some 7,000 could bring security to the region. That's obviously not going to happen. Now you've got to put those same NATO-quality forces along the border with Chad and Central African Republic. Something has to stem the violence into those. You're going to see the whole Horn of Africa collapse if we don't stop it here. But the plea for protection was just what will haunt me the rest of my days.
Well, Somalia is going to be a big problem in the Horn of Africa, but we're talking that whole area seems to be one step away from blowing up. Eritrea is having tensions with Ethiopia. Somalia is not resolved.
Right. So it doesn't help to have two more collapsed states. We're talking now about a very fragile government in Chad. Debbie, many attempts at coups, and Bozizé hanging by a thread. So Darfur's violence could completely topple both countries.
Now, on this trip, you blogged through the UNICEF website. Did you find that to be a helpful exercise?
Yes, because it was a way of getting back word of what was happening, and I hoped to, through that their website and also through my own blog, to draw people in and engage people.
And you also held a Q&A session on the Washington Post website.
Did I? Okay.
Well, I've seen some of the questions and answers. One wrote to you, a lot of celebrities are being very public with their involvement in causes for Africa. George Clooney was just there with his father. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are there and have visited places. Singer Bono's very vocal. I guess that's
He's
a pun.
Been great.
Is that a trend? Is it good for celebrities to get involved in all of this?
Look, I can't speak for other people. The people you mentioned I have a very high regard for. I think that it is incumbent on all of us to do our utmost. And whatever that means for you, that means for you. Whatever it is for me, we have different ways of doing our utmost. I'm here talking to you. That's a huge thing, giving voice to, you know, hundreds of thousands of voiceless people. So that's what I can do.
Well, what about the African Union? Didn't they put together a military force to deal with issues like this?
They did, and you know, they should be supported in every way. But what happened, we don't want to see them fail, but they have in fact failed in Darfur. They were not supported sufficiently. They were not trained well enough. They were in insufficient numbers. And worst of all, they had a pathetic mandate to come in as a so-called to observe the peace, which was non-existent, and they didn't have the capacity to protect. And so they have failed in Darfur. The people in Darfur now, if you mention the African Union, the people in the camps and villages, they jeer. They're angry. They say all they do is write things down. And they themselves have been attacked. They are deserving of our support, but they don't have the capacity to bring the safety to the people. They just don't. And they themselves have said so. They need UN support, and big time.
When you first became a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, weren't you primarily involved with the effort to eradicate polio, which remains a problem in Africa as well, doesn't it?
They invited me to come in, and it wasn't as an ambassador. They just knew I had had polio. They know I have a son who is paraplegic as a result of polio. I have adopted him from India. And so they thought I would be a spokesperson on the issue of the eradication of polio. And then they expanded my role after a few years.
And how well is the campaign against polio going?
Well, because of northern Nigeria, and we have Islamic extremists there, we almost were there. The goal was by 2005 that there would be a global eradication. Unfortunately, a lot of cases of polio have come out of that region and have spread. But it's not in the numbers that it was, but it's still not under control.
Now, we don't want to give the impression that you've totally abandoned your acting career. You were recently in The Omen as Mrs. Blaylock. You received good reviews for that film, at least.
Thanks.
Also in Arthur and the Invisibles.
Yeah.
Are you doing the sequel?
Hopefully, we're supposed to do it next summer. And then I have a Michel Gondry film coming out with Jack Black called Be Kind, Rewind. So it's been a wonderful year for me.
And how are you able to do this? Are you able to schedule trips to deal with your strong political convictions in between making a living?
You know, it's really more humanitarian. I really haven't been terribly political, but I tell you, if you go there and if you bear witness in that way, I mean, I became profoundly changed by my trips there. And my mandate is now been given to me by the people of Darfur, and it's eclipsed everything else. So I've been fortunate, and it's loads of fun, and I've been really blessed to be able to work. But it's just an immense privilege and an immense responsibility also to go to Darfur and into that region and to try to represent the challenges the people there face and to remind people again that above all, they need protection, protection, protection.
You will also hear some years back to talk about a very different kind of thing, a theater project, where you were one of the many actors who participated in talking about people who had gone to jail, who should not have gone to jail. Mm-hmm. It was obvious that that you really enjoyed doing theater.
Yes, and I've since then done Fran's Bed for James Lapine, and that was loads of fun. I do love doing plays, and hopefully I will again.
Any chance you'll be going before the UN or before Congress to talk about
these
issues?
I'm talking at the UN tomorrow, yes.
The reason I mentioned the movie stars is because it's an unfortunate situation, but if I were to go on that trip and come back with exactly the same information that you came back with, people would not listen to me the way they listen to you.
Well, if you were Reuters or AP, because we brought those two along, they've had articles that have tremendous coverage. This guy, Alfred de Montesquieu, was in Chad, and I've seen huge, huge coverage. So I guess you got to link up with a big press agency.
Well, again, Reuters is a European agency. The French press has been covering this story in a lot more detail. And for some reason, this is something that's relegated generally to the back pages in the American press.
The fact that it's a little, it is under the radar and you have to look for it. And that's why I say to people, you know, go to my website and it will link you to all the places if you want to inform yourself more. And ask of your local press, you know, say we need to know more about Darfur. Let's raise the profile to the point where governments have to do something.
Your website once more?
It's miafarrow.org.
Mm-hmm. And you said there was another website?
Well, they're all linked on my website, yes. SudanDivestment.org. You know,
Mia, thank you so much for being
thank
with
you.
Us again.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow, Keith Glass, a longtime agent for basketball players, tells us why he feels the NBA is in trouble. And then artists Dorothea Rockburn and Linda Benglis look back on the period of the late 60s and mid-70s when a lot of great artwork was being made, plus a new novel based on real cases when women suspected of having venereal diseases were sent to detention homes during World War I. Also short story writers Rick Bass, Mary Gordon, and George Sanders comparing notes. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Brad Ludlow and Angie Sheldon. Debbie Darcher was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.